This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. You know, if we think about bacteria at all, our thoughts tend to be pretty simplistic. I mean, we think they're bad and we should kill them. And humans have gotten really good at doing just that, using antibiotics to annihilate bacteria that cause things like strep throat and ear infections. But the carnage has come at a cost. Superbugs are evolving that can defeat antibiotics, and modern medicine seems to have no backup plan. So what if instead of attacking bacteria, we tried a more diplomatic approach? Nadja Cech is a professor of chemistry at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. She studies how bacteria communicate and looks at nature for ideas about how to interrupt them. Nadja Cech, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here. So these little bugs are talking to each other?
They are. This is an idea that has fascinated me ever since I first heard about it, this idea that bacteria can communicate with each other. And really, one of the things that's been incredibly satisfying in my work has been being able to pick up those signals. I remember, actually, the first day that my student, Yas Junio, who was working at the mass spectrometer, we were trying to see if we could pick up the signals the bacteria are producing that enable them to communicate, and we saw it for the first time. And I just remember that peak on the mass spectrometer and Yas showing me the data, and we were just jumping up and down and celebrating. It was like, it was sort of a dream.
Was it like a little sign? They're watching us.
Something exactly like that.
Because we're going to talk in a second about why it would matter for us if we're just trying to not be sick, that these things talk, that they communicate. So how do they communicate? Give us a sense of what it was you saw.
Well, we have bacteria all around us all the time. They're all colonizing our skin. Many of us are aware of this, that this idea of the microbiome, that we actually have more bacterial cells in our bodies than we have cells that are human cells. And the way that they're communicating is that essentially, even if there's just one bacterium sitting on your skin, it sends out a signal all the time. Sends out a signal of what's called a cyclic peptide, a small, medium-sized molecule that can be picked up by another bacterium. But it takes a critical number of these signals to be present before the other bacteria can pick them up. And the way that you get more signals is by having more bacteria. So if you have a lot of bacteria on your skin, suddenly there's enough of these signals that they bind to receptors on other bacteria. And when that happens, essentially it's a signal that tells the bacteria to totally change what they're doing. Instead of just hanging out peacefully, they can start to mount an attack.
That's cool. That is so cool, because that's the interesting thing. I would assume that the bacteria is by itself my enemy. One of those things gets in me, it will do whatever damage it could before my immune system would find it and root it out. But therein lies the problem for the bacteria, right? If there was just one, that would be the end of the problem, and I would never get sick.
Exactly.
So these guys wait until they achieve critical mass before they start acting in a pathogenic way. That is the way to make me sick.
That's absolutely right. And what's even more interesting to me is that, you know, our assumption of bacteria is bad is, of course, an oversimplification, because there's all different types of bacteria all around us, and some of those bacteria play very beneficial roles. Some of those bacteria are helping us digest our food, and it turns out that some of the bacteria that are living on your skin actually protect you from the bacterial pathogens, the bad guys. And so what is really interesting is that those signals that can activate the bad guy bacteria to attack are the very same signals that can communicate across species as well. And what we see is that some of the beneficial bacteria living on our skin actually produce signals that prevent the bad guys from colonizing our skin. So there's communication not just happening amongst bacteria within an individual species, but across species.
So your body, or the bacteria that's living on you and has colonized us, and this is a whole other question of how much of us and how much of them is us.
What is us?
What is us, right? Yeah. Who is the parasite here?
Yeah.
But this means that they've been defending us that way without our even knowing it.
Exactly.
And you were the one who figured out, why don't I know that? And you were the one who knew it then.
Okay, so let's be fair. This whole concept of a community extends not just to bacteria, but to the scientists as well. So I am a little piece in the big community of scientists studying this. Yeah. And that's also part of what I find so fascinating is that, you know, I was talking about my student Yas Hunio, who made the discovery. My students are often the ones that make really interesting discoveries in the lab, but also the ideas that we have are inspired by collaborations with other scientists. So I work with a microbiologist, Alex Horswell, who originally got me excited about this idea of bacterial communication. And I work with a dermatologist in San Diego who's actually got patients with severe rashes all over their bodies, and he's treating them with healthy bacteria and using that to clear up the rashes. So there's a whole network of people involved in this kind of stuff.
To talk about the implications then and the way we would treat bacterial infection or prevent bacterial infection now that we know this, if we ever got good at disrupting their communication.
Yeah, so I'm really interested in either using beneficial bacteria themselves as a way to treat infections, so knowing which bacteria are producing the molecules that inhibit the bad guy bacteria could be one really useful strategy, and we're starting to see that pan out actually with some of the collaborative work that I'm doing. And also, all organisms are constantly living in symbiosis with each other in various ways. And so bacteria produce molecules that alter other bacteria, and then other organisms also produce molecules that can alter bacteria. That's where antibiotics come from. That's the whole discovery of penicillin, which comes from a fungus, kills bacteria. The reason the Penicillium fungus makes that penicillin is because it's protecting itself, but then we can take that molecule and use it to protect us against bacteria. The idea has been all along sort of this idea of, we're in the arms race with the bacteria. Let's find molecules from nature that we can use to kill bacteria. But part of what my work is looking at is using molecules from nature rather than kill bacteria to disrupt their communication. And the idea is that if you could disrupt their communication, you may not be putting that same pressure on them to morph into the highly drug-resistant superbugs.
Right, because that has been the collateral damage, right?
Exactly.
The blowback is that they've developed a way to fight the antibiotic or survive the antibiotic, makes them a superbug. And also, there's the unpleasant side effects. I mean, if anybody who's taken an antibiotic for one reason realizes that it cleans out everything, and that causes problems.
Yeah, exactly.
So there's a way around this. And also, I understand, because the first time I was introduced to this idea, it was with respect to viruses as well. So right now, we're in this arms race with them, where we come up with a vaccine that's about maybe sometimes 50% effective, not always 50% effective, like the flu vaccine. And then the next year, the virus says, well,
yep,
we've moved on. And so it's out with a new vaccine. But if you could do this with viruses, they don't even know.
That's the idea, is for them to not even know.
Right. Now, so where are we in the research, and how close are we to developing this as a strategy for us?
There is actually one therapeutic that's in clinical studies right now that relies on this idea of inhibiting bacterial virulence. But most of the work that I'm doing is very much on the front end of trying to really understand the bacteria, with the idea that if we understand them better, we may be able to come up with better ways to, let's say, coexist with them rather than necessarily just trying to wipe them out.
Because this works in social structures. That's how the 2016 elections, right? The Russians disrupted our communications. And then, you know, something happened. So it should work.
I think so. It's already been tested. We call that a clinical study. It's a large-scale clinical study.
Talk more about your research, though, and how you got started in this, because, you're looking into the world of fungi in particular, I
mm-hmm.
think.
Yep.
Which is also, you talk about the communication among fungi, and then mm-hmm. I've learned about how trees use fungi as communication networks to talk to other trees.
Yeah.
So really what you're doing is taking a look at systems as a whole and working from the whole down to the particular, which seems to me to be not the way science always works.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by this idea of systems. Science tends to be, it's very easy to look at things in a reductionist way, to try to change one thing and see what happens. And of course, that's an oversimplification, but it's also challenging to try to look at a more systems-wide perspective. So you asked about how I got into this. So I was raised by hippies in Oregon. My parents went off the grid in the 80s and raised us in a community, an alternative community there. And so I guess I've been part of a system of people that think about things a little differently, and also just living in the natural world and very, very close to nature in my upbringing, and always out in the garden. And my parents would let us explore freely in the woods, and we could spend the day building forts and climbing trees. And my dad would blow a conch shell at the end of the day, and we'd all come and hold hands and sing and then have dinner at the communal table. So, you know, it was sort of this idea of the system as being important is something that I think has really been a part of my reality my entire life. And it's very interesting to take that into a scientific context. And
well, I would think maybe just interesting and disorienting. When did you go into a formal, or were you in formal education even in your hippie days?
So I was not in formal education in my hippie days. The first time I was in a formal classroom was when I was 14 and I started at community college. Up until then, I'd been homeschooled and been part of some alternative school experiments of various sorts that involved a lot of outside time. I love the community of people in the university as well. It's just a different community. So I think it's part of figuring out what everybody's strengths are and how they can work together.
No, analysis certainly has its moment, and there's a place for breaking things down to
yes.
digestible bits, right? And looking at the bacteria and having them scream, they're looking at us.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, that's a good moment. But again, you just don't want to lose sight of the system, because things don't act the same way when they're being looked at. And
that's true.
A scientific principle, as it turns out. Was it jarring for you? Because you had been learning. You'd been taking on all kinds of information, right, as somebody who's running around the woods. Your head is full of knowledge, but perhaps not in a way that the community college recognized it. Or was that a problem? Was there a cultural barrier at first?
You know, I was always a nerd. And when I got to community college, I was like, oh, my people. It was great. Like, here's people that would love to solve equations with me all day. So, you know, to be honest, I may have fit in a little better in college than I did with the hippies, but I love them all.
You did it to get back at your parents, right? I'm going to do my homework in my room, and I'm going to sit with my hands folded on the desk. You did that to make them mad.
Yes, perhaps. My parents are really, really smart hippies. My mom is a wonderful mathematician. My dad is a great writer, and so I really benefited from their experience and perspective. So although technically I'm first generation, I actually come from my parents left sort of normal society to go off and do their own thing, but they also benefited from having a background that included a lot of higher education.
I think an uncle who is a Nobel Prize winner.
Yes, my dad's brother is the Nobel laureate, and then my dad's the one that went off to live with the hippies. So my uncle has the Nobel Prize in biochemistry, and my dad's a brilliant botanist, but very much self-taught. So I've really benefited from being part of both of those worlds.
So we'd have to know your grandparents to know who is making them mad. Was it your uncle or
your
dad?
Oh, it was definitely my dad. their Nobel laureate son was not the one making them mad.
I make these blunderbuss, distinctions between sort of the holistic way of knowing and the more siloed way, but it's not that way. And I do wonder, though, if there's a shift and there's a more widespread acceptance, and whether or not we're seeing in the academy just a more robust understanding of how networks and systems can actually inform.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the big challenges has been developing the tools to actually enable us to do that. So that's a lot of my work, is saying, okay, everybody agrees we should be looking at this in a more system-wide way. It's much more difficult and challenging to consider 10,000 variables than it is to consider one. So how do we develop a way to really look at this really complex problem in an effective way and still come up with a meaningful story to tell?
Well, how do you do that? Is computer technology helping us there?
Absolutely. Computer technology, mathematics. My collaborators are mathematicians, they're computer programmers, they're mass spectrometrists, they're biologists, they're community members that understand the questions we should be asking. It's a very diverse group, and a lot of it comes down to making sense out of really complicated data.
Yeah, and I would also think, because there is, ESP, I think of that, or I think of other sort of phenomena that we've all been exposed to and we get, so there it is.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what kind of test tube you fit the little, the magnetic wave that got transferred, right? But we all have experienced it, and it seems to me that starting from that experience, we all know this happens, and then working our way down. I mean, is that one way to design the tools?
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's and that's where you do have people being more accepting than you would expect of, the hippies coming into the academy, is that we all understand this concept that the interconnectedness, and that there's more going on than what we can necessarily measure. And so the question then is trying to expand our ability to measure, to be able to capture some of that.
We measure with the tools that we have. It's
exactly.
Not immeasurable in any way.
It's not immeasurable. It's just pushing that envelope a little bit wider.
I am glad you're doing it.
Thank you.
I am so happy to talk to you. Nadja Cech is the Patricia Sullivan Distinguished Professor of Chemistry at the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. Nadja, thank you so much for talking with us. You can find out more about her work at our website, stateofthings.org, and get a daily preview of the lineup. Sam Frazier's been playing. He's going to be at North 87 South in Graham on Sunday, May 25th. Going to be playing with the band, his band Side Effects, at Earl's in Winston-Salem on June 8th, and at Doodad Farm in Greensboro. Sam, the reason I love having you on is because I get to say North, South, and Greensboro, Doodad Farm. It's just being able to name those places. That's the reason
you're on. We cover the bases.
And you're a terrific musician. You can find out more about Sam Frazier at our website, stateofthings.org. A program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, Jennifer Brooklyn, Robin Copley's our technical director, Al Wadarski helping out today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio. Once again, Sam Frazier.
Last night, I dreamed I was a genius. I dreamed I was a genius. Last night, went to sleep guilty and woke up mean, but I was a genius in between. Last year I started out lazy, then I went a little crazy. Last year I passed out in the lobby, came to in the mezzanine. I was a genius.